Welcome to Midday, everybody. I'm Sheila Cass. Thanks so much for joining us. In a little over an hour, President Obama and former President George W. Bush will be among those speaking at a memorial service for the five police officers killed in Dallas last Thursday, killed by a sniper after what had been a peaceful Black Lives Matter march to protest the fatal shootings last week of two African-American men by police, Alton Sterling in Baton Rouge and Philando Castile near St. Paul, Minnesota. Here in Baltimore, the defense continues in the trial of Lieutenant Brian Rice, the highest-ranking officer charged in the arrest and death of Freddie Gray. Gray was fatally injured in police custody last April. Yesterday, Judge Williams dismissed a charge of second-degree assault. Rice still faces charges of involuntary manslaughter, reckless endangerment, and misconduct in office. And some other data points. A little more than halfway through 2016, Baltimore has experienced 150 homicides this year, 90% of them shooting deaths. Compared to last year, non-fatal shootings in the city are up 10%. Just last evening, a gunman opened fire on a vigil for a homicide victim in West Baltimore. Five people were wounded. All are expected to survive. A lot to try to make sense of. With me this hour is Baltimore Police Commissioner Kevin Davis. He was confirmed as commissioner last October after serving as interim police commissioner and deputy commissioner of the Investigations and Intelligence Bureau. Before coming to Baltimore, Commissioner Davis served as chief of the Anne Arundel County Police Department. And before that, he retired as second in command of the Prince George's County Police Department after 21 years of service there. Thank you so much for being here.
Gosh, yeah, I haven't seen you in a while. A little Catholic guilt built up because of that.
We haven't talked about what happened last week.
Right.
How did you react to that?
Well, a lot happened last week, not only in Dallas, but in Baton Rouge and in Minnesota. And I think the conversations that I and others have about those three incidents and the lives that were lost in Dallas and in Baton Rouge and in Minnesota, I think we have to be careful not to, because our words matter so much, not to appear to prioritize lives. I think all these lives that are lost are equally tragic. It's a challenging time in our profession, in our country right now. So, the conversations are very necessary, but I want to be careful when we have these conversations that I don't appear to prioritize one over the other.
What did you tell your officers about last week's shootings?
Well, I reminded our police officers that it remains a noble profession, and the challenges of police work aren't unlike they have been in the past, in spite of the moment that we find ourselves in right now. And I think the emotions that tend to swirl whenever there's tragedy, and particularly whenever police officers are killed in the line of duty, and to be killed in the line of duty like they were killed, murdered in Dallas is quite different. Those were intentional sniper shots, premeditated, calculated, cold-blooded murder. So that adds an element of emotion. But I think police officers serve society best when we remind ourselves that the dangers of the profession are not unique to the profession. It's always a dangerous profession to a degree, and I think police officers in Baltimore and elsewhere, the ones that wear uniforms and drive marked patrol cars, tend to be the younger members of our profession. And we just have to, remain calm and remember that, we're here to serve. And our profession is one of service. And unfortunately, there's danger associated with it from time to time.
I'd like to hear Dallas Police Chief Brown spoke with reporters yesterday, and at one point, sort of not in response to a particular question, he shared his view of what police are up against.
We're asking cops to do too much in this country. We are. We're just asking us to do too much. Every societal failure, we put it off on the cops to solve. Not enough mental health funding. Let the cop handle it. Not enough drug addiction funding. Let's give it to the cops. Here in Dallas, we got a loose dog problem. Let's have the cops chase loose dogs. Schools fail. Give it to the cops. 70% of the African-American community is being raised by single women. Let's give it to the cops to solve that as well. That's too much to ask. Policing was never meant to solve all those problems. And I just ask for other parts of our democracy, along with the free press, to help us. And not put that burden all on law enforcement to resolve.
So that was Dallas Police Chief David Brown. How does that sound to you? I mean, I should point out earlier in that same answer, he talked about how he was running on fumes. He's under so much stress. So maybe that's not the way he sees policing all the time, but it's the way he sees it right now.
So I know David Brown, and he's a colleague and a friend, and I've had many conversations with him over the last 4 or 5 years or so. And I don't think there's any better police chief in America. And what he seems to be saying is not unlike some things that I and others have said. So when other aspects of government or society seem to break down or fall short, so whether it's health or transportation or education or mental health or drug addictions, when all those government and society entities fail a person or fail a family or fail a neighborhood, the only entity that is left standing to deal with the ramifications of those challenges is the police department. We're the 24/7 face of government anywhere you go in America. And we're typically the only part of government that's working at 2 o'clock in the morning when someone is experiencing a crisis. And the mental health challenges and the developmental disability challenges in 2016 are unlike at any other time in our profession's history. And I've been in this business for 25 years, and the challenges that young police officers face dealing with folks and families and neighborhoods that aren't served well by other aspects of government or society are greater than they ever have been. So I think what Chief Brown was trying to say is, you know, the police seem to be, from time to time, the jack of all trades, masters of none. But what we really do is we do pick up the pieces because, you know, we can't choose not to respond to a person in crisis. We can't choose not to respond to a 911 call. Most of the law enforcement encounters we have with people in Baltimore and elsewhere do not result in someone's arrest. They're people in crisis, families in crisis, and you know, we have to better select and train our police officers how to deal with those folks.
And do you think you're getting the support that you need?
Well, I think when you look across the country at, you know, healthy governments, and I just look at my relationship with Dr. Nguyen here in Baltimore. Dr. Nguyen,
the health commissioner in Baltimore,
you know, one of the most talented persons I've ever come into contact with. And she and I speak routinely and meet quite often and talk about the, you know, public health and public safety going hand in hand. So when we talk about crisis intervention, we're doing bigger and better things with crisis intervention within the police department. We're identifying families and neighborhoods that experience crisis, and we're not waiting for the next crisis that manifests itself in a crime of violence to occur before we go to that person or family or neighborhood. So the reality of it is a lot of these eruptions, particularly within families and within neighborhoods, are predictable. And if they're predictable, I would argue that they're often preventable. So we just have to do a better job as government.
Give me an example of a predictable eruption.
Routine calls for service to a family's home, routine calls for service to a particular block or to a particular neighborhood that don't necessarily result in a crime but require a police presence. So as opposed to just responding from call to call to call, the way our profession is heading in Baltimore and elsewhere is to involve other aspects of government to help that community before something happens. And that could be transportation. That could be health. That could be education. That could be domestic violence. That could be drug addictions. So we're looking at what Seattle has done with their law enforcement assisted diversion for people who are addicted to drugs. And we're looking to do things differently to help drug addicts. Incarcerating drug addicts, for instance, Sheila, doesn't necessarily reduce violent or property crime. We have to find a way to treat people who have these challenges. And I'm proud of where our profession is right now, in spite of the turmoil that we now find ourselves in, particularly in the last week, because this this country is populated by police leaders, and we have 18,000 police departments in our country who now get the reality and the necessity of collaborating with other government agencies and other community partners to make public safety something that's just not the responsibility of the police department. The police officers only have so many tools to deal with folks, and a pair of handcuffs has traditionally been looked at as a way to solve problems in communities, and it's a temporary fix at best.
That is Baltimore Police Commissioner Kevin Davis here on Midday on WYPR. I'm Sheila Cast. You can join our conversation if you've got questions for Commissioner Davis. Send us an email at midday@wypr.org or phone us at 410-662-8780. Baltimore police came in for some criticism for showing up at a vigil for the local rapper Lor Scooter after he was killed, showing up in riot gear. The event was largely peaceful, but it did block an intersection. Do you think having police in riot gear was the right response?
Well, let me back up, because that's a characterization that's inaccurate. We spent several nights in that community along the 1500 block of Pennsylvania Avenue in Upton at several vigils for Lor Scooter. So that particular night, there was a peaceful vigil that was going on, and some cars pulled up along that 1500 block of Pennsylvania Avenue, and it drew the attention of just a few people from that peaceful vigil. And what those few people did, and very, very few, is they entered the roadway and they were jumping on top of occupied and unoccupied cars. And the police presence was not one of a civil disturbance presence. They were police officers in their regular uniforms. And then some rocks and bottles were thrown. And then of the approximately 100 police officers that responded to that incident, maybe a dozen had partial civil disturbance equipment on, and that was in response to some rocks and some bottles that were thrown. And I've said time and time again that type of behavior by just a few people is something that Baltimore is not going to tolerate. So, when you say that
Baltimore won't tolerate it, what does that mean we should expect in terms of how police present themselves to the community at a time?
We presented ourselves that week in a collaborative way. I was up there that night after the incident occurred. And then I was there two more nights at the same location with the same folks in the same neighborhood. And it was very, very peaceful. So there was a small group of people that detracted from that vigil, that peaceful vigil. They decided to act in a manner that's inconsistent with that neighborhood. The neighborhood doesn't want that. And they were dealt with. We made a grand total of, I think, two or three arrests. And the rest of the week in that community, that very same community with the very same people, we had nothing but peaceful events. And just like the Friday and Saturday protests that we had in Baltimore over the weekend, we had peaceful protests. And that's something that the police will facilitate, participate in. We had our police chaplains out there. We were handing out water to the protesters. We made four arrests. Three of the four people we arrested reside outside of Baltimore City. And they decided to sit down on Pratt Street in an effort to shut down the traffic on a major highway, and that's not something that it's going to happen. So we handled that Friday and Saturday, I believe, very, very well.
We have to take a quick break here, and we've got quite a few people already who want to be part of this conversation. I welcome your calls at 410-662-8780, or you can send us an email at midday@wypr.org. As I said, quick break, and then we will be back with Police Commissioner Kevin Davis. Stay with us. Welcome back to Midday, everybody. I'm Sheila Cast. Police departments across the country are struggling to gain the public's trust following highly publicized police-involved shootings. In Baltimore, the death of Freddie Gray last year led to protests and last April's notorious civil disturbance. The Baltimore Police Department is awaiting results of a Department of Justice investigation into allegations of excessive force. This is all fodder for us to talk to Police Commissioner Kevin Davis about. He is here with me in Studio A. I want to ask you in particular about the new use of force policy. Went into effect last Friday. First time the use of force policy has been completely revised in 13 years. What is the best way, what is the most important thing for the public to understand about what is different now when a Baltimore police officer makes a decision about whether or not to use force?
Well, many things, Sheila. And when I took this job just over a year ago, Mayor Stephanie Rawlings Blake was very clear to me that she wanted me to pursue the best practices out there to make the Baltimore Police Department better. And the mayor, to her credit, just to remind everyone, invited the Department of Justice to take a look at our police department and to offer avenues for us to get better. So one of the ways that we knew we had to get better, before you modify behaviors and mindsets, you have to have policies and procedures in place that identify what the organization expects of its employees. And our use of force policy had not been altered, revised since 2003. So Chuck Wexler is the director of the Police Executive Research Forum, and he has praised us over the last several days for being the largest police department in America to adopt the bulk of the Police Executive Research Forum use of force recommendations that recognize the sanctity of life, that compel police officers who witness misconduct when it comes to excessive or unnecessary force to report it. That
you're saying, let me just translate that into ordinary language.
Sure.
You're saying a police officer is required to tell on another police officer if she sees excessive force used.
Absolutely. And that's now in a policy. So it's no longer just a vague expectation. It's something that's in a policy. It's now in policy that we have to seek transport for someone complaining of an injury. That's something that's new. And the use of force review.
That was not, until last week, that was not actually a requirement.
It was not spelled out. We went from a 6-page use of force policy to a 14-page policy that spells out in detail what's expected of our police officers. And the police officers I've spoken to over the last several days are thankful for the direction that is finally given in now what is a robust policy. Not with suggestions, but direction. So, you know, we're in a much better place with use of force. And our use of force reviews, the reviews that take place up a chain of command when force is now used, is more formalized and more robust. We have a use of force review committee at headquarters now, and that's something new, that reviews all of the use of force cases that take place. You know, I'm really proud that so far in 2016, and like you said earlier, we're more than halfway through the year, our excessive force complaints are down 40%. Our overall complaints from citizens are down 25%. We've sustained 23% more cases than we have last year. We haven't lost a single trial board since I've been the police commissioner. And again, all
you
these...
You haven't lost a single trial board. That means...
That means that
anytime you the department lodges a complaint against an officer, that complaint has been upheld?
No, it means that the more serious complaints, police misconduct complaints that require an administrative hearing board, typically those are the complaints, once they're sustained, that can lead to someone's termination.
Mm-hmm.
We're being very successful with those administrative hearing boards. Since I've been a police chief, I've terminated 6 cops who don't represent this profession the way it deserves to be represented, and another 7 have resigned. And I say all that not to scare cops or to appear to be, laying down the law within the organization. The accountability that needs to exist, that is being built within this organization, builds esprit de corps. And the overwhelming majority of cops in Baltimore and elsewhere consistently do the right thing. And I think that's important for Americans to remember. And I know that's what Chief Brown has been saying in Dallas. There's 900,000 police officers in America. They're people just like everyone else. They're husbands, their fathers, their sons, their daughters. They wake up and they take on a very challenging profession, and they consistently do the right thing. And more so than at any other time in my career, I believe we have a better quality of police officer than we did 25 years ago. It's hard to see from time to time, but I believe our profession and the quality of police officers now is better than it ever has been. And I know that might be difficult for people to wrap their arms around, but I think we're better selected, we're better trained, we're better educated, and I think we get now the necessity of a relationship with the community. It's not perfect, it's far from perfect, but it's something now that's widely accepted.
I've read the new use of force policy, and I know this. What I'm about to ask is not a stated goal, but do you expect, as this policy is put into effect, that there will be less use of force by Baltimore police?
Well, it's not a matter of using less force. It's using force when it's appropriate to do so, and it's de-escalating before force is used, if there's an opportunity to de-escalate. Now, there's not always an opportunity to de-escalate. When someone's pointing a gun at you, the capacity or the ability to de-escalate is certainly a different thing. But de-escalation training is one big thing. I sent one of our commanders to Scotland with the Police Executive Research Forum to see how they train to de-escalate interactions between the police and citizens. But we're already receiving less complaints. And another thing, and again, you know, kudos to Mayor Stephanie Rawlings-Blake for the body-worn camera program. We got our first batch of 500 in. They're being distributed across the city. And by the time we get everyone outfitted with a body-worn camera, we'll be the largest agency in the country with a fully implemented body-worn camera program. So we'll see less complaints because of that. We're already seeing less complaints with force. And get back to your question, will force be used less often? That's my expectation that it will be used less often because we're going to have more sophisticated de-escalation training in place.
This is Midday on WIPR. I'm Sheila Cast in the studio with Baltimore Police Commissioner Kevin Davis. Lots of people want to be part of this conversation. James has called us from Northwest Baltimore. James, welcome to Midday.
Good afternoon. Thank you for the opportunity, Sheila and Commissioner Davis.
Hi, James.
Foot patrols in residential areas as opposed to only in business areas is one concern of mine. I have emailed you, Commissioner Davis, and called your office numerous times concerning drug dealing in the 3700 block of Racerstown Road, and I have visited the Northwest District saw three different district commanders, and they know that we have drug dealing in my block. They've come and seen it, and I've asked for foot patrol, yet and still, I still got open-air drug dealing in my block. So as a concerned taxpaying citizen who just received his tax bill today, property tax, it's ironic that I have the opportunity to speak to you because when you have people like myself who pay their taxes, who try to work with the police, and they get no assistance, what does that really say about how police feel about our community?
James, I appreciate the question. Let me let Commissioner Davis address it.
Yeah, well, thanks, Sheila. And James, I certainly feel your frustration. I really need to put you in contact with Major LaTanya Lewis. She is your district commander in the Northwest District. The last Police Academy class that graduated, James, they exclusively walk foot patrol for 3.5 months before they get inside of a police car. And the class that we just graduated spent their first 30 days in our Western District, and their next 30 days, which is right around the corner, they're going to spend in your district, the Northwest District. So it's my expectation that you'll see more foot patrol up there. I'm sorry we haven't spoken earlier. I will find a way to get back to you with Major Lewis.
James, if you can stay on the line, we'll get your phone number and we'll give it to Commissioner Davis before he leaves the building, okay? I appreciate your calling. Derek is calling us from Pasadena. Derek, welcome to Midday.
And once again, I'm humbled and honored that you invited me on your show. A lot of the rage toward police, well, first of all, let me stop here. I'm married to a teacher. And she and I agree that teachers, as well as police officers, really have to bear the burden of societal issues unfairly. And both professions are underpaid. And I understand the stresses and the tensions. I would argue that teachers are better trained. They have a more rigorous training process. Not much of it is physical. And they have a more relevant and rigorous review process because they are reviewed by their administrators, by their teachers, and so on and so forth. But I think the rage in the country, if you're, you know, when you look at these videos, you might not necessarily be seeing criminal activity on part of the police, but what you are seeing is unconstitutionality. We're not seeing due process in these videos. We're not seeing equal protection under the law. We're not seeing people's constitutional rights. In other words, when I deal with police, when police show up, it's clear that they're expecting to be the final authority, but the American citizen is expecting the Constitution to be the final authority. And I appreciate the reforms that Commissioner Davis, you are enacting, but I also know under the Police Officers Bill of Rights, you have a, I think like a 5-day period, as I read it, for police officers to review any like video before they're interviewed. Now, the common American citizen is not granted that ability, and that's the concern that people have, that you're not, there's this ongoing issue around the country where police officers are acting in an unconstitutional manner, and then the burden is put on the citizen to redress it, to report it to the police station or to deal with it in that way. And I think that's really the core of the issue.
Derek, thank you for putting it on the table. Commissioner Davis?
Sure. Well, Derek, you said a lot there, and you know it all kind of boils down to the selection of people to serve in this profession, identifying the people with a heart and a capacity, a service capacity, and then once we get those people identified, it's training. So the training that takes place in the police academy in 2016 is far different than the training that I was afforded 25 years ago, and what holds police officers accountable, what the tool that will help hold police officers accountable to that training that exists now and didn't exist previously is, again, the body-worn camera. So as we review routinely and randomly review police officers' encounters with citizens, we can see if reasonable suspicion existed. We can see if probable cause existed. And we can see if those elements of a police encounter, particularly a stop, question, and frisk police encounter, we can see if those elements existed before a police officer engages in an enforcement mode with a citizen. So I'm looking forward to, you know, to continuing to enhance the training that we have right now. It's you know, really an opportunity to get better as a profession. Again, I think we've made significant strides, not only in Baltimore in the last year, but in our profession over the last couple of years. We've got a long way to go. You know, no matter where I go in Baltimore or elsewhere, communities need the police. Our residents just want a respectful interaction with a police officer. They want to be treated like family. They want to be treated like the police officer would treat his or her own family. And you know, someone told me years ago that the communities will begin to trust their police departments when they know that their police officers treat them respectfully in their homes and in front of their houses. So that's where we're going in Baltimore.
Derek, thank you for calling. While we've been speaking, we got an email from Karen who writes this. One of the items which never seems to be discussed is that the reason the police are frequently behaving with excessive force is that a lot of them probably have PTSD because of what they encounter on a daily basis. I never used to be scared of young black men until I got mugged by one of them. Afterwards, when I see a young man of a certain type, my heart starts to beat rapidly and I start to panic. I can imagine a lot of cops view certain types of young men as the enemy or the other. And which raises the question of what kind of training you do that would address that kind of implicit bias.
It's implicit bias training that we have within the organization. It's trauma-informed care that we partner with Dr. Nguyen and her health department to bring to all of our police officers. One of the observations I made early on when I got to Baltimore, and again, Baltimore is our nation's eighth largest police department, is that we didn't have any organizational psychologists inside the police department. And those organizational psychologists that exist in other police departments deal with police officers who are experiencing some type of trauma or emotional event in their personal or professional lives. We didn't have that within our own organization. And I went to the mayor, and to the mayor's credit, again, she said, put them in the budget. So we put two spots in the fiscal year 2017 budget that began just a few days ago to hire two organizational psychologists for the Baltimore Police Department. And they'll be able to identify police officers who are experiencing stressors in their personal lives and their professional lives, and we'll be able to get them some counseling or some help before those stressors manifest themselves in a use of force scenario on the street that was otherwise preventable.
So that hasn't started yet. You're just now in the budget have the money.
We're hiring right now. We're advertising, and you know I don't want to steal any lines from Chief Brown out in Dallas, but you know I think one of the other things he said, Sheila, was that you know if you want to make this profession better, and we all want to make this profession better, it's a noble profession. It's a profession that must exist in a civilized society. We have to have police in a civilized society. Join us. And I think what he was really saying was, hey, you know, particularly for the young people out there, you know, consider this profession. Consider being part of it. Consider serving your community. And that's a sentiment that I certainly echo.
Well, you have brought me to a question that I was hoping to ask you at some point, which is, why would any young person want to be a police officer? Right now, there is so much tension. There is so much criticism. I mean, what motivates someone to become an officer? And which leads us then directly to the fact that you've got a huge number of vacancies. You've had quite a few officers, like 20 a month on average, leave the department.
Right. That's normal. That's not something new.
But you are down significantly. You're like what, 250 down from your.
So we are authorized strength. We are down from our authorized strength, and we're hiring to fill that. It's a tough time to recruit, Sheila, in this profession. That will change. We just sent a group of recruiters to Puerto Rico.
I read that.
Where we pre-registered 1,600 police applicants who want to be police officers in Baltimore. So what's happening here with our recruiting is not unlike what Philadelphia and Washington and Chicago and other jurisdictions are experiencing. What I hope motivates someone to become a police officer is a heart to serve their community. I hope that's the motivation. I hope as challenging as our profession is right now, it's still equally rewarding to help people and to help communities. And that's what I hope motivates people. We just put a class in of over 50 police trainees in our police academy, and it's my hope that each and every one of them is motivated by a need or a capacity, a willingness to serve.
But one of the things that concerns citizens is that so many police are not from Baltimore. The heart to serve the community, but it's not their community. We got an email from Galen who said, I've heard that 80% of Baltimore City police live outside the city, with a sizable percentage living as far away as Pennsylvania. How does this affect the officer's attitude toward the city and the people who live in the city?
Well, Sheila, I think one of the factors that connect police officers to this jurisdiction or any other jurisdiction is an off-duty connection. So if you're going to the grocery store, if you're coaching a little league baseball team, if you're going to church, if you're walking your dog, and it's in the same place where you police every day, I think that matters.
Sure.
Do I think that's the end-all, be-all deal breaker? Absolutely not. Because, again, if you don't have that capacity to serve in your heart, I can't give it to you. And I can't place you geographically in a house or an apartment or a townhouse and think that that's going to change your capacity to serve. You have to have that in your heart to begin with. But I do think that young people seeing police officers in an off-duty capacity bodes well for our relationships with the community. I'm a cop of a son, and my dad was the
son
beat
of a cop.
What did I say?
Cop of a son.
Yep. Reverse that. Turn that around. I'm the son of a cop, and he was the beat cop in my neighborhood, and you know, everybody knew it, and that was something that was sometimes a source of frustration for me and my brother, and sometimes a source of pride. But everyone knew my dad in that community. He coached my baseball team. Everyone saw him in church. And they knew him not only as Officer Davis, but as Mr. Davis. And we need people in our community, particularly our young people, not to just know us as police officers, but to know us as their neighbors.
We need to take another quick break. Lots more to talk about here on Midday with Baltimore Police Commissioner Kevin Davis. Join the conversation with an email to midday@wypr.org or by calling us at 410-662-8780. I'm Sheila Cast. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Midday, everybody. I'm Sheila Cast. I'm here in the studio with Baltimore Police Commissioner Kevin Davis, and we're taking your questions at 410-662-8780 or by email at midday@wypr.org. Before the hour gets completely away from me, I do want to ask you about what you're expecting from the U.S. Department of Justice investigation. Loretta Lynch said last May, "This investigation will begin immediately and will focus on allegations that Baltimore Police Department officers use excessive force, including deadly force, conduct unlawful searches, seizures, and arrests, and engage in discriminatory policing," which is a pretty heavy list of things to be looking at.
Sure.
We were expecting that we might have heard from the Department of Justice by now. They had said somebody had indicated late June, early July. We're now at July 12th. When are you expecting to hear from them, and what are you expecting?
Well, we're expecting to hear something very, very soon. And again, to kind of back up to last year, the mayor requested the Department of Justice to come
right
here. I think that's far different. That's a far different thing than the Department of Justice imposing itself on Baltimore. The mayor saw the necessity for improvements, and she requested the Department of Justice to come in and conduct a civil rights investigation. So I've interacted with the Department of Justice on many occasions, constantly, as a matter of fact, throughout the last year. I stood up a Department of Justice compliance team full time. All they do is interact with the Department of Justice. I lived through, as you probably remember, a 4.5-year consent decree in Prince George's County. So I expect the Department of Justice will soon, and define soon, I don't know, this summer hopefully, release their findings. And then after they release their findings, they'll a period of time will go by, and then they'll announce their remedy. So the remedy can be something in the form of a consent decree. It can be a memorandum of agreement or a memorandum of understanding. I'm not sure what the remedy is going to look like, but I do know that no matter what the findings and no matter what the remedy, we will inevitably and undoubtedly have already started to work on most, if not all, of the deficiencies that the Department of Justice has identified. None of those deficiencies that they're going to identify will be a surprise to me. Because we're in constant contact with them. I know.
And you are not
are
holding off making changes,
no,
waiting for the Justice.
I revised the use of force. We've done other things within the organization. We're not waiting to get better. But I do welcome their findings, welcome the future relationship with them, and I know it'll just make us better within the agency and you know, most importantly, in the community.
Nicole has called us from Towson. Nicole, welcome to Midday.
Good afternoon to you both. First, I want to say that I've listened to several of Commissioner Davis's interviews, and I'm very encouraged by him. I really like what he says, and I hope that, you know, he's given a chance to actually get, you know, some of the things that he hopes to have happen done. That being said, I actually listened to the Baton Rouge, Louisiana information, and I heard that both of the cameras, the body cameras worn by the police officers, dislodged in the whole incident. And I want to know if they can dislodge that easily, how effective they can be, since our police officers here are going to be wearing them.
And Nicole, thanks for the question.
Yeah, Nicole, thank you for the question, and thanks for your faith. And I promise to work very hard for everyone. One of the things that the mayor wanted to do when she announced that body-worn cameras were coming to Baltimore is she just didn't want to jump into the deep end of the pool and grab a camera off the shelf and hope that it worked. We, at the mayor's direction, had a pilot program that lasted a couple months, and we entertained several different proposals from vendors, and we chose what we believe is the very best camera, body-worn camera out there. So I'm not a subject matter expert in body-worn cameras, but I do know they can attach to your person in many, many different ways. There's a very strong magnet feature, is a clip-on feature. You know, we are training our police officers not only in the new use of force policy in Baltimore, but on the body-worn camera policy in Baltimore. We also recently introduced a core operating procedural manual, a COP manual, to the Baltimore Police Department. The Baltimore Police Department has 209 policies, and that's a big number. So we identified the 26 policies of the 209 that we believe police officers have to know like the back of their hand. And we put that and literally put that in a manual that we call a cop manual. And every other week, a new policy is taught to the whole agency. So getting back, Nicole, to your question about body-worn cameras, we think we've got the best one on the market. We think we've got the best training available to police departments. And, you know, we're going to do everything we can to make sure that those cameras function the way that not only the police department expects them to function, but people like you, Nicole, and others expect them to function when we interact with our citizens.
Nicole, thank you. I don't want this hour to get away without mentioning the shooting near right around the time of the anniversary of Freddie Gray's funeral. A 14-year-old kid in Baltimore named Dedrick Colvin was shot by Baltimore police by a Baltimore police detective. He was carrying a BB gun that looked very realistic. And he was shot in the shoulder and in the leg. Does that incident comply with the new current use of force guidelines?
Well, that incident is still being investigated, but I'll say this about that particular incident. And I visited that young man in the hospital. I visited with his classmates in school. And I vividly remember the press conference we had the next day. And the replica firearm that that young man was carrying was a replica Beretta 92FS semi-automatic pistol. And the reason why I remember that so vividly is that's the firearm that I carried for the bulk of my career in Prince George's County. And when I first got to that scene, Sheila, and they told me that it was a replica firearm, I said, bring me to it. I need to see it. And when I walked over to that gun and I stood over top of it, I couldn't tell for the life of me that it was a replica firearm. So at the press conference the very next day, Director T.J. Smith and I stood there and we put the replica Beretta 92FS next to a real Beretta 92FS, and no one could tell the difference. The media even asked us which one was which. So I, you know, continue to be an advocate for better laws that govern the possession of these replica firearms. But that particular police-involved shooting is still under investigation. I have said from the very, very beginning that given the circumstances that were presented to the police officers who are acting without the benefit of hindsight, and we never operate with the benefit of hindsight when we're involved in these critical incidents, I believe that the police officers were correct to believe that firearm was indeed real.
The other thing that I remember from that whole sequence was that Deidre Colvin's mother was taken into custody for several hours. She was not charged, but she was taken into custody. And quite frankly, I'm wondering whether that would have happened to a white mother who was distraught.
Yeah, and I've spoken about race, Sheila, with this particular case, and I've even used my own 13-year-old twins as an example. But that kind of gets back to de-escalation training. And, you know, when we deal with a mother, no matter what race a mother is, and she is obviously, understandably, visibly upset because of what just happened to her child, I think we have to find better ways to interact with that person. Did we handle that mom perfectly that day? No, we didn't. And I've had some tough conversations within the organization about
have you apologized
different
to
ways. Have I? No,
have
I have
you
not,
apologized
I have not
to
spoken to the mom. And typically what will happen, Sheila, during these police-involved shootings is the investigation will take place. And listen, I'm probably more so than most police chiefs in this country. I'll go sit down with families and victims of crimes and other people who were impacted by crime, and I'll have conversations with them. But until I know all the facts in this particular case, I'm not in a position where I feel comfortable right now talking to the mom. But having said that, I don't need to wait till the end of an investigation to realize, hey, maybe we could find different ways to deal with grieving parents. So that's something that I'm willing to certainly acknowledge.
Let's try to squeeze in at least one more phone call. Victor has called us from Baltimore. Victor, welcome to Midday.
Wow, thanks for taking my call. There's so many things here. One thing I wanted to comment on was the one person that emailed and said until she was mugged, she wouldn't have felt a certain way, and the police officers have to deal with that all the time. And I wanted to say, interesting, because I grew up in the hood. I've seen guns and dope and gangs and all of that. I grew up in Southeast Washington, Anacostia. I'm in Baltimore now. But my point is that feeling that you get when you're in the hood and you know that someone's behind you about to do bodily harm, and you're saying to yourself, your mouth salivating, you're saying, all right, I got this. Be calm. You act like you know. I get that same feeling when a police officer pulled me over. I'm in my mid-50s. I've been pulled over probably 8 times this year. I drive a black Jaguar that's 10 years old. Once in all of those times that I was pulled over, I got a warning ticket. All those other times when they were walking up to the car and asking for my stuff, my driver's license registration, and I knew everything was in my... It was almost like I was in the hood and someone was about to rob me. At that same, I'm telling you, heart beating, like, all right, calm down, you know, do everything right. Almost like I'm walking through the hood about to lose my life. That's how I feel.
Victor, I don't mean to cut you off. We're short of time, and I want to give Commissioner Davis a chance to respond to what you just said. Thank you for calling.
Yeah, well, thank you, Victor, and I know Anacostia well, and you know, I cannot argue you out of how you feel when you're stopped by police officers. It's certainly heartbreaking to hear a grown man in his 50s have a fear of the police, and that's not something I'm going to try to argue you out of. Our profession, again, Victor, has a long way to go to make sure that the actions police officers take on the streets are consistent with our training. And I think when you see police departments that are in an unhealthy place, sometimes they'll have training and policies and procedures that meet best practices across the country. But the way that those policies and procedures are either adopted or ignored on the streets, that's where you get the gap. So we think that body-worn cameras will help resolve that. We think better training for supervisors will help get us to a much better place. And, you know, we're just not going to stop until we get to that place, not only in Baltimore, but in our profession.
We have to leave it there. I really appreciate your spending the hour with us. Thank you.
Thank you, Sheila.
Baltimore Police Commissioner Kevin Davis. I also want to thank Joe Squared for providing lunch. Joe Squared serves coal-fired pizzas, risotto, local craft beers. Locations and hours at joesquared.com. And thank you for listening. Tune in tomorrow. The United States has the highest incarceration rate in the world, but there's a growing bipartisan effort to change that. How did conservatives come to support prison reform? That's tomorrow. I'm Sheila Cast. In the coming hour, WIPR will be airing NPR's live coverage of the memorial service this afternoon for the Dallas police officers. Stay with us for that.
Midday is produced by Maureen Harvey and Andrea Appleton. The show is engineered by Luke Spicknall. Music produced by Jeff Truman and High Gravity Sounds. Midday podcasts and live streaming are available at WIPR.org or on demand using the WIPR app. This is WIPR, your NPR news station.